Session number 11939, rule 17.
Mr. J.R. Williams, Reel 17. What was your next engagement after your involvement with the French, Mr. Williams?
Well, I'll preface my answer to that by telling you that Tunisia is all hills and dales. I think one of our generals called them these cursed Djebel. A Djebel is a hill or a mountain. And we were always having to fight up hills most of the time. But we then began to operate on the business of... I suppose we use as a form of stormtroops. We put an attack in on a German position, or a German-come-Italian position, because the Italians were still there, but it was mostly Germans, just before it got dark. And we hoped there would be trace of line, my mortar bombs bursting and so on. Germans would create a few casualties, we'd lose a few casualties, but the whole place was in a state of alert. Then we'd stop, march out, get under trucks. In my case, I'd get into my carriage and follow the trucks down, go a little way down the line, 10 to 20 miles down the line, south or north, debus, and go into action at dawn, and beat the place up again at dawn. The Germans cottoned on to the fact. They must have taken some prisoners, because they had a local Tunisian radio, so we once heard them talking, and one of them said, I remember the simpleness of those days, "It's all right, Swifty Howlett. We know where you are." Because Swifty was a nickname for our brigadier. Obviously, one of our poor soldiers and nervousness, when he asked who his brigadier was, he said it was Swifty Howlett, you know. But I remember the brigadier said, did you hear those Germans? They referred to me as Swifty. Did you think they knew I was a fast bowler for Kent? We had to keep our faces straight, you know. He was really pleased about being called Swifty by the Germans, you know. And another thing, at that time, we took a German officer prisoner. And at that time, the Italians were proving very unreliable from a German point of view. They were very human beings, Italians. If they didn't want to fight, they wouldn't fight. And we said to this German officer, "How do you get on with your Italian allies?" And he replied in immortal words, "You have the Americans and we have the Italians. That makes us equal, doesn't it?" That was when these other people were, you know, what to call them.
What was your next action?
Well, the next main action was we had to attack a hill called Djebel Boudis. Djebel Hill, B-O-U, means father of, and Dis, I don't know what that stood for, but it was a big hill. And just before that, I must tell a little incident going. I was getting ready, and I had my motor, and I was on mules on this time. I was taking them up on mules. And I had French muleteers, you know, French soldiers, muleteers. And we were standing behind, getting ready. And suddenly, Mike Fuller, this other officer, came up and he said, I said, "Hello, Mike." He'd come up with his batman to bring some stuff up. He said, "Are you in battle?" And I said, he said, "Do you never get left, LOB, left out of battle?" I said, "I can't, Mike. I'm the only officer there." He said, "Well, that's not bloody fair." He said, "I'm being left LOB. He said, "I'm a regular officer. I've got to make my living." He said, "They've got no right to leave me out." I said, "Well," he was acting second in command. I said, "Well, you get your turn." He said, "Bugger that for a lark." And I said, "Now, Mike, have you been drinking?" He said, "I've had a drop of rum because you've been bringing the things up and so on." I said, "Well, look, just go back and wait, and then the next battle, you'll be in and your company commander." Because they had that system, you know, when there was a company commander, second in command, to avoid too many casualties, they would leave one time, the company commander would be left behind, and the second in command would take the attack in. And that meant that they had a reserve of officers if anything went wrong. I might tell you, on at least two occasions, when we got some heavy losses, the CEOs got on the bloat and we said, "Jack, come up and take over D Company till the second in command got up." And I suddenly found myself in command of infantry company, you know. That's just by the way, I'll tell you about it later. Well, we had to attack, and I said to the Mac, he said, I'm going to this bloody battle. I said, you can't, Mac, you're LOB, go back, they might have some function for you to do later on. He said, they're not bloody well doing that to me, I'm a regular Dermot infantry officer. I said, have you been drinking in the realm, Mac? He said, yeah, I've had a drop. Well, I said, no, just don't drink anymore, get the hell out of it. He was just young, he was 19 in 1939, so he'd be about 22, 23 then. And we went into this attack. Now, normally, when we attacked, Jerry retired and counterattacked at dawn. But this, there was a big hillside, and we were going up all covered with stones and boulders, and he suddenly decided to stay and fight. And what is worse, there were English-speaking ones who had A Company this way, they were saying, our A Company was rushing up into the fire and so on. And the stuff was flying in all directions, and I said to my batman, tell the Frenchman to unload the mortars and so on, and get our blocks out. And suddenly, the sergeant in charge starts shouting in Arabic. And I just saw, in the sort of starlight and light, I saw the mules' heads turning round. And something told me, he's going to go away with the full mules. And I don't know what they said to stop him. But my batman hit him right between the eyes with the butt of his rifle, and he dropped unconscious. He couldn't say any more. And the mule stopped turning, and our blokes unloaded them. And they said, right, alley. And they all went off away. But it was quick thinking on the part of this batman of mine, plenty I told you about, who had picked them off the ship. And we were creeping around, and I fired some mortars, but I had to be very careful with firing very short range, because our men were still on the hillside. Then the enemy retreated. And we got up the hill, and I was telling you, I had two mules with me, which were carrying my kit and so on, and I saw there was a sharp hill dip on the other side, which was taken in the dark, and I suddenly heard some sound over there, and I saw the mule's ears go up, and it took breath in to nick it. I told me the Germans must have mules at the other side. And if you place your fingers inside the nostrils of a mule, it will stop them from whinnying. And I placed my nostrils inside his septum, you know, and stopped. And then I said to my blokes, Jerry's just over there, the mortar range is, because you couldn't fire below about 800 or 900 yards. I said, I'm going to try something anyhow. I moved all my men back, and I stood my mortar straight up in the air. And the lad said, you'll drop the bloody bomb back on yourself, sir. I said, women, the wind's blowing in that direction. Now, if it's blowing in that direction a few hundred feet up, I've just managed to drop that bomb just over the top of that lip. So I said, you lads get out to hell and get undercover. And I put the mortar straight up there and dropped a couple of bombs down. Stood waiting. I thought I was going to die, so it was no one. But they did drop just over the lip. And I heard the mule squealing, and I heard the scatter of the Germans going away. So that I committed a heinous sin of firing on the conditions when I might have dropped the bomb back on myself. But I took a chance. The wind was blowing that way, and I thought, well, if it's blowing the same way higher up, I'll get it. And we got on top of this hill, and I got into a slit trench near the top so that I could observe, and my mortar was a bit lower down. And the Germans attacked at dawn, coming up the hill. It was a similar sort of hill rising to which we'd attacked in the dark. And, you know, every now and then the Germans did silly things. It was a bad place to attack. But it started, came up shoulder to shoulder. Obviously to keep their morale, you know. And I said, well, look, Christ, we'll never get a chance like this again. And we really flattened them. And I was shouting my fellows, I had a machine gun up there, because I had it added to me. We had six medium machine guns by then, Vickers. And I said, now, you must carry out my instructions. There were dead Germans on the hillside and some wounded. If you see a German creeping away, shout, "Kommen Sie here!" I want you to remember that a wounded German behind a Vickers machine gun, behind the equivalent in German, can kill the whole battalion. Shout to him, make sure he hears you, to give him his chance to come creep in to you, then if he doesn't kill him. No wounded man who's fit to crawl back must be allowed to crawl back into the German lines. And I showed him, I killed one, I showed him what to do, you know, borrowed a rifle. And that's the way. And they were really badly. Then we took one officer prisoner, sent him back down. They attacked at 10 o'clock in the morning after them bought him. and we blasted them again. And the fit ones got back and again were killed. It sounds rather cruel, but a wounded man can be just as dangerous. They were given their chance. Come as you hear, he said. And some of them looked back like that before they started creeping away, so kill them. The whole was littered with Germans. And then at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, as we later discovered, all the German officers had been killed. And it was a sergeant major bringing them in. And he was saying, links, Richt, links. He was keeping marching up in time up this hill. We blasted them again. And he flopped on the ground and said, come on to here. And the survivors came in. They were absolutely refusing. And it was a sergeant major with the last war ribbons on. And we said to him, he spoke English. And we said, very well done, sergeant major. A very brave attempt. He said, I was an artilleryman in the 1418 war. If we'd had my old artillery, you wouldn't have got away with this, you know. And we said, well, never mind. It was a very brave effort. And he then said, is it true that you English have automatic 25-pounder guns? You see, our gunners, and the ones supporting us were Harry Seacombe and Spike Milligan, you know. The gunners were so good that the Germans really believed it was automatic fire, whereas the men were serving each round at a time, you know. Each round at a time, putting bridge. And we said, no. He said, I'd love to see those guns. He said, they've almost struck me that if they're being manned by men, he said, they must be very well-trained soldiers. So we got on the blower to the artillery people and said, we're sending some a German down to the cage. He's an old sergeant major. He's an old soldier of the 1418 war. He's very interested in your guns. He thinks they're automatic. I said, as far as I know, he had a party when he got down there, rumming all sorts of things. But he saw the guns, as far as I understand.
What date was this, do you recall?
I don't know. This must be in that March or something like that, you know. The whole thing was kaleidoscoping into it. It was also there where I had some nonsense. I had 8 prisoners lined up. Now, I should preface my remarks by saying that we were instructed by the CO that good men who'd been in the battalion a long time could still become battle-weary. And if any man deserted who was a good soldier, the CO would blame the officer. So he said, keep your eye on
him. On what grounds?
For letting them get to that stage. He said, keep an eye on them, he said. And if they start biting their fingernails or trembling unduly when there's shell firing, send them on a message down to the quartermaster. He's in the game. And you'll keep him, you'll give him a cup of tea and keep him down there for a sleep overnight and then send him back up the line. That'll just give him a chance to rest. Well, I also, one of my blokes was getting a little bit uppity. I thought, we had 8 German prisoners. And I said, any German speak English? And one said, I speak English. And I said to this man, you take those prisoners down to the cage. And this cheeky sort of a German stepped forward and said, I am not a prisoner. And I said, you are a prisoner of war. He said, I was captured. I did not surrender. But he was, I suppose that was a German sort of thing. If they didn't put their hands up and not fight, he was captured while he was in extraction. And that doesn't matter. And I said, fall back in the line. Let's have no more of this nonsense. And he tossed me up an archer salute instead of a military salute. And this lad of mine who was standing by there stepped in front of me. It hit him between the eyes with the butt of his rifle, and this fellow picked himself up. He had these little square sort of German glasses on, incidentally, this lad. Typical crowd with short cropped hair. And his glasses were broken. There was a great crack across his jaw. His nose was bleeding. And he staggered up onto his feet and gave me a perfect military salute. I said, fall in. I said to this bloke, now, remember, you go down the line, take these down, stay down with the quartermaster, have a cup of tea and come back up tomorrow. But look, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 Germans. 8 Germans must be delivered down at the cage. I don't want any shooting, because he was in an awful state. Later on, word was passed to the Germans through the usual Swiss lines that in future, if a German prisoner gave a British officer a Nazi salute instead of a proper military salute, it would be regarded as an offensive act committed after being taken prisoner, and an officer would be at liberty to shoot him. So after that, we got some magnificent military salutes. And That was where... Now, we lost quite a few casualties up there. Quite a few casualties. I should also tell you that when we were waiting to go up the line, this suddenly along came a long string of these Goumier. And so, no, along all four, and all came up to see me, shaking me by the hand, completely without any sense of risk. They didn't stand to me, shake me by the hand. One of the mules pushed my pocket as they were holding him. He'd asked where I was to keep my sugar sweets. You know. So that was months, 30 months after. And incidentally, this Mike Fuller, as we were lying there and creeping around trying on this hillside, suddenly rushing up the hillside came Mike Fuller with his batman. Come on, fellas, we can do better than this. Charging in front of the jet, and there was a German threw a grenade, and Mike was on the ground. And we said, are you hit? Mike said, yeah, I've been hit. He said, something happened to my leg. But listen to me, and I'll tell you. And he was saying, there are Germans over on the right, open up, and things like that. And his leg was off. Went to see him in hospital. He had about that much of his thigh, just a stump of his hand, hopping around. I said, well, you're a bit of a BF, Mike. Well, he said, at least I got in a bloody action anyhow. I said, well, you won't do any more soldiering after this. Well, he said, they had no right to down my infantry officer like that. In that connection, I should mention that all the time, I was the only officer who was never left out of battle because there was no other officer. And also, I made a point. You see, I made another arrangement with the CO. Incidentally, Henry Lovell, at one stage, sometime... He was invalided out, and we got a bloke called Paul Bryant, who had been second in command. He took over. Paul was quite a nice bloke. He was a member of Parliament after the war. I sometimes used to go and have a cup of tea with him in the House of Commons in 1947 and 8, you know. But I made an arrangement with Henry and also with Paul. The copybook says that the motor officer is a technical officer. It will remain at battalion headquarters to give advice to the CO and so on. And I said, now look, sir, I'm not sending my men to an attack with no officer. My sergeant, my platoon sergeant, is quite capable of giving you any technical advice. Well, I shall move forward with... We normally used to attack with two mortars with one attacking company, two with the other. I'll take turns. I'll go up with that company one time, that company another time. But I must go forward, so my men must see me as their officer in action. I'm not having this nonsense of me staying behind the headquarters.
How did you stand the strain?
Well, I didn't have any strain. I don't know why. Whether I was able to shoot things off and so on. I just once, on this Jebel Boudis, there was one incident which just made me take a long drink of water and have a little licking of my lips. There was a German mortar shell dropped right into a slip trench. And we moved the blocks away, and the sergeant and I went round and scraped the guts right round. He'd just been splattered all over. We scraped them all into the slip trench and kicked some muck on top. And then I wiped my feet on the side of the ground. And just that moment, I thought, well, I'm going to die. Don't blow me apart. What difference would it make if I was dead? I don't know, but there it was. But normally it didn't worry me because I had my men to look after. I enjoyed shooting my mortar. Also, it sounds rather slithers, but I was convinced, and I still say to this day, it was my duty to kill as many of the German officers and men as possible. That is, I don't mean shooting prisoners and things like that, but kill them and destroy them. And I say to this day, my wife sometimes tells me, it's two or three generations since this happened. I say, we still didn't kill enough of them. Those Prussians are now pouring back over the border into the middle of Germany from East Prussia, East Germany. They'll be at it again shortly. But and that just job was to fulfil. I used to sweat many a time, you know. I suppose there must have been times I think, oh God, how nice it would be to go home. But I never felt in action. I never felt worried. I felt, well, fate's fate, you know. And
where did you go after this particular action?
Well, after that action, we came out, and then we... now, this would be March, I said, wouldn't it? We did another little stint around the mountains there, but there wasn't a very fixed action. And then we were pulled out in the Majerda Valley. And there was a big hill in the Majerda Valley. This was getting towards the end. And on the 23rd of April, 1943, it was Good Friday. Not the latest that Good Friday can be. And there was a place there called Jebel El Amira, which is called the Black Mountain. And we called it Long Stop, because it was at the end of a valley, again, this cricketing thing, and it was a big mountain just down here. And you went round it and across the hills, and you were into the... you were approaching Tunis. And Long Stop was a strong position, and we were detailed to attack it. I went across through the cornfields into the... The cornfields ran right up the bottom of the hill, and we had to go through the cornfields with my mules. I had my mules with me, and we got... There was a big barrage coming down, and we got there about dawn and tried to get up the hill, and we were really being... I remember lying there, and I was holding it. Well, I was holding one mule, and the bloke's holding the other. The mules were cropping away the grass unconcerned, but you'd hear a nasty plop, and you'd see a bloke's head disintegrate almost and roll over. And the Germans were really firing us, and we were suffering. We had some quite heavy casualties. And the brigadier called in the Argyles, who were in reserve. They were in a wadi. You didn't call them wadis in Tunisia, you called them weds, O-U-E-D. A wadi is a sort of Libyan and Egyptian term for a dried water course. And you bring the Argyles in to support us. And there I saw one of these magnificent things which I remember all my life. Out came the Argyles, each section in arrowhead formation, perfect order, with a piper playing on the right. First thing, we heard the pipe music, and we saw the Argyles coming across. And Jerry lifted the barrage off us and hit the Argyles full blast. It was like a World War I barrage. And you know, you see a corporal with three men on either side in arrowhead formation coming in. The smoke descended, and it was flying up, you know, the rocks and everything were flying up. And through the smoke came maybe the same section, and there'd be a corporal there, one man on that side and two on that side, and they hadn't all the business, came marching on. And they got the head of it, and the pipe was still playing. And as far as I can gather, I made inquiries, he was playing Glendaroll Highlanders. That's the tune which says Campbellton Lock, which full of whiskey, Campbellton Lock, okay. Because that was the regimental march of this particular battalion of the Argyles. And when the Argyles got level with us, our cockneys went charging in with them. I said, you buggers didn't think you'd ever charge to a bagpipe. They said, no. And the other, pipe major was killed just over on the right. He just folded his pipes up as we were moving up, and I saw him move off the right here, and he was marching out, and then he was hit and just collapsed. We had to hunt. We found his body, and we found the CO, Colonel McNabb of the Argyles. He was killed as well. He dropped in the corner at the bottom of the thing, and we found him by the smell of the, you know, the people decomposed pretty. And only by smelling around it, we found him in the deep corn. We got up this hill, and Jock Anderson, one of the majors, he was a support company commander. He charged up ahead of a big hefty bloke who played rugby. And he destroyed about five German machine gun posts. We got the top one, and that sort of saved it because the place was littered, but it saved a lot of casualties. And when we got up there, one of the company commanders with me, when he said, "Well done, Jock." And he was sitting lying exhausted. And he said, "How's that for grouping?" And there was a German machine gun crew there, and every one of them had a burst of Tommy gun bullets through the head, you know. And he got the VC for that. And we got up on this hill, and we were... In our battalion, one company effectively was destroyed, and so we only had three companies left. One had 35 in, one had 23 in, and we made the other one, a composite one, from a few Marines in 60, so 60, 35, instead of four full companies. And I was up there with my mortars, and I dug in. And I always remember a shot was flying in all directions, and then there was scrapping going on the hills over that way and over this way, and we sometimes got a bit of respite. And I was lying up there, and a mule was brought up by some brave member with some letters. No, two for me. I remember lying down, and I put the first one up was from divisional headquarters, saying, if you have lost any of your carriers in a minefield, please advise map reference and whether or not it is recoverable. What the hell, they're worrying me to time this one. And opened another one was from my sister, who was a Methodist and religious. The Easter card with chickens. I said, God bless you on this happy Easter morn. I told him that later. I said, you nearly made me say some rude words about this one. And then we were there, and the CO said, Jack, the Buffs are going to attack on the left. Go forward and see if you can give any help. So I said, oh, man. I said, I'll leave my motor and I'll go and wreck it. And I ran across the ridge of the hill, and I thought, I'll never get the end of this bloody hill. I was just running across the ridge, and I got up, and there were some dead men and some wounded Buffs lying down there. And then I looked up, and suddenly I saw the Germans pouring out of the last part of the hill with their hands up like that. So I just walked back with my hands in my pocket and said, no attack, no mortars required, Jerry's packed in. Oh, good, he said. Good news, Jack, he said. And that was the finish of our attack on that Long Stop Hill thing. And then we subsequently attacked along the valley in stages, approaching Tunis. The Jerry were still fighting a little bit. But we'd already got the 4th Indian Division, and I think it was 6th Armoured Div, from Monty's lot. He'd been held up at Enfidaville. Everybody said he rested it. He wasn't. He couldn't get past Enfidaville because he was running into... He wasn't in the desert where he could use his troops like an admiral using ships. He was up against the same sort of land as we'd been fighting, so he was held up and sent back... They sent these Gurkhas and the Indians through. Then we attacked. And the only significant thing that happened after that, up to taking of Tunis, one of my blokes was very badly wounded, and I was propping him up against my leg on the ground, giving him a drink of water. He said, we'll get you away as soon as possible. I said, I think I've had it, sir. Don't worry. I said, come on, I'll pull yourself together, we'll do it. He was dying. And my this left leg was saturated with blood, was running down. You know, we wore khaki drill trousers, you know, the drill, light drill trousers. But you didn't wear shorts because you had to be aware of mosquitoes. You had to have, and we wore sort of just ordinary battle dress tops because it broke the outline when it was dark. It had two different colours. And then the next day we left them, we moved along, and we were going through a place where we'd been attacking, and there was a young German lying there. He said, Wasser, bitte, Wasser, please, water. And I leaned down and... I saw he was very badly wounded. And something made me... I didn't want to prop him up against my leg, which was coming... So I propped him against the other leg. He must have been wounded the same way. Blood was running down here. And I tried to give him a drink of water. He grabbed my bottle from me and drank the whole bloody lot. I had one day in Tunisian thirst without any water. Williams, I'll hold on to the bloody bottle next time. And he died. I laid him down. And we got into Tunis. There was always an argument about whether the 8th Army or the 1st Army got in first. I don't give a bugger. I got in my carrier by time, and I was moving in, and all the Arabs and so on, and a few civilians, French civilians, shrieking with joy, clapping their hands and so on. And I looked down, and I had one leg completely saturated in English blood, the other one completely saturated in German blood, and I thought, I'm sure there's something else I could be doing instead of this. And that was how we got into Tunis. Well, I think it would be the 7th or 8th of May when we actually were in and occupied the town and resistance had stopped. And then we just moved through. I subsequently had some little administrative jobs to do. And Monty came in, full of his usual braggadocio and so on. And the first thing they did, on the local cinema, they put Desert Victory on. And the other interesting thing was they had to arrange that members of the 8th Army, members of the 1st Army, didn't go into Tunis on recreational duty together, because the first time I was saying, where the hell have you been? We've been waiting all this time. And the 8th time I was saying, you had to wait for us to bloody well do the job for you, didn't you? Which caused a certain amount of friction. That football, the hooligans, there was a certain amount of scrapping went on. And so they said, right, 1st Army in one day on the morning, 8th Army in the afternoon, the next day, 8th Army in the morning, and 1st Army in the afternoon.
Was it a victory parade?
There was a parade, yes. As a matter of fact, I've got a thing left. There was a parade and there was a usual service, you know. service of thanksgiving and so on.
What had been your own platoon losses?
Well, I'd lost a few men, but comparatively few, because I don't know why it was. They weren't actually rushing into action first thing, you know, but we were close up. We were under shell fire, and in many cases we were on. And I lost one or two sergeants and one or two other ranks, but really I wasn't to be compared with the ordinary infantry platoons, you know. It was just luck, I think, because they were in every battle, you know. I mean, there was no respite. Nobody ever got any help. You know, you might not go rushing in with the first thing. And then, of course, as I've said, sometimes I took over company. If the company command being killed and they're waiting for the second commander, the CEO said, "Jack, slip up and take over and keep those lads in order while, until the other bloke comes up." And that was it.